Morning, Your Honors.
Just a moment, Mr. Blagan. I assume that there's nothing about your impending presentation that has driven almost everybody out of the courtroom. I'm confident this is not a judgment on your brief.
Well, we'll see.
Well, the rustling has died down. So, Mr. Blagan.
Morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court. The Fifth and Sixth Amendments to the Constitution of the United States guarantee due process of law and the right to a trial by an impartial jury.
My God, I hadn't known that.
And fortunately for us, the Sixth Amendment...
Everybody else knows.
The Sixth Amendment says it right in the amendment, so it's obviously a major point. William Allen was denied that right in this case, and he is entitled to a new trial. This was a case charging Mr. Allen with advertising, distributing, and possessing child pornography. And as part of its efforts to root out potential bias, the parties in the district court came up with a jury questionnaire, a private jury questionnaire, in which juror 31, the juror at issue, no less than four times indicated that she had a bias.
It seems to me this case really all boils down to one thing that she says to the district court in the process of these. There are a couple of times when she's asked about it, where she finally says, I would give him the benefit of the doubt until everything is presented, yes. And then the judge says, all right, well, you strike me as a fair-minded person. She says, thank you. She goes away, and he decides to keep running. Of course, eventually she sits on the jury. So you need to explain to us why that statement, once she finally brings herself around to saying that, is not something on which the district court should have relied.
Because, quite simply, it mixed apples with oranges. The apple was her bias based on a previous incident where she believes her daughter there was an attempt, kidnapping, or sexual assault on her daughter, and that created a bias in her, which she quite honestly told the court on several occasions.
Right. She puts it in her questionnaire.
Correct.
And so on, yeah.
The benefit of the doubt related to whether she could give the defendant the presumption of innocence, and those are separate matters. The presumption of innocence is entirely separate from a bias. I could be a juror in a case where it's against someone, and I could say, I have a bias, judge, because that defendant shot me last week. But because I believe in the law, I can apply the presumption of innocence. I'm not an impartial juror. Because I have never made, much like juror 31, the unwavering statement that I can put my bias aside. And that's what the district court never got to. And it's
very... Why can't you say that?
Excuse me?
Why can't you say that? Jurors say that all the time.
I'm sorry. Can't
I say
why
what? Can't you say that? Jurors say that all the time. They can't... He suggested somebody has a bias against people who indulge in pornography. And they might say, can you set that bias aside and rule only on the evidence in this case?
Of course she can say that.
And the answer is either yes or no. And if it's yes and the judge believes her, and there's no real reason not to, why not?
And Judge, that your fact scenario is very similar to a case, United States versus Brodnicki, which is discussed in the briefs.
Yeah.
And in that case, the court said, and I think you wrote the opinion, that because the person said yes, I can set my bias aside, and the district court obviously believed it, then the defendant was out of luck. But in this case, the juror never said, I can set this bias aside.
She said she could give him a fair trial.
She didn't say that either. She said she could give him the benefit of the doubt, but it was in response to a question about the presumption of innocence. We have set forth in our brief, we attached the transcripts.
Read the transcripts.
Yes, and that's what she's responding to. The district judge never gets the unequivocal statement from her, the unwavering statement, as the law requires, that she can set her bias aside. And that's what puts this case into the realm of Thompson versus Altimer and Gray. In Thompson, the juror said, and it was a civil case, the juror said, I believe that some people file frivolous lawsuits in employment matters. And this court said, well, that's a pre-existing belief, which is kind of like a bias, not quite as bad. But in order to sit as a juror, that person has to say unequivocally, without wavering, that they can set those previous beliefs aside. And it's the same analysis for bias. And the judge never got there.
Here we have, I'm looking at your appendix, and this, it doesn't have an appendix page number. It's 142 in the jury selection. And unfortunately, everybody's talking at the same time. So the judge says, do you think you can start right out the case? And she says, I could try. Well, we have a lot of cases that say I could try. It reminds me of Yoda in Star Empire Strikes Back. There's no try. And the court says, with the presumption of innocence, that's what you just said, that they're talking about that. And then the judge says, there is not anything wrong with having an impact. I don't know what the judge meant by that. But is it whether just the nature of the charges you find so offensive that, and then she says, no, no, you will not give the guy the benefit of the doubt. And that's when she says, I would give him the benefit of the doubt until everything is presented. So there's a lot mixed up in that little segment.
There is a lot. But in my view, I mean, I don't know
what
precisely.
What does the judge mean by there is not anything wrong with having an impact?
I don't know what he means, but I think if he means, I think he's wrong. There is something wrong with it having an impact. What you have to be able to tell the judge is that I can set that impact aside or I don't believe it will have an impact. And you have to say that unequivocally, which she never did. I don't know precisely what the district court, what Judge Koukouras meant when he said that, but he starts it off with talking about the presumption of innocence. And that's what I believe in a juror's mind, the benefit of the doubt relates to presumption of innocence. They're not quite the same thing, and as we pointed out in our briefs, I'm not sure she even unequivocally said, I can apply the presumption of innocence, because I don't think presumption of innocence and benefit of the doubt are exactly the same thing. Now, considering that she's not a lawyer, she may consider them to be the same, but it certainly is not an unequivocal statement that I can put my bias aside. And, as in Thompson versus Altimer and Gray, this court said, look, if you had asked the right question and gotten the right answer, essentially the district court's judgment would be unassailable. But in this instance, the judge didn't ask the right question and didn't get the right answer, except at the very beginning. At the very beginning, because of the jury questionnaire, and she comes up for a sidebar, Judge Koukouras says, Do you think that experience, the experience with her daughter, would somehow prejudice you against the defendant in this case? And she says, the only unequivocal thing she says in the entire transcript, yes. So we start, we have an unequivocal, it would somehow prejudice me against the defendant. And she never changes that in an unequivocal fashion. She never says unequivocally, I can be fair, I can set my bias aside. The judge got halfway there with the presumption of innocence, but didn't get all the way there by asking the appropriate question about bias. I see that I'm going into my rebuttal time, and I'll reserve what I have left.
Counsel?
May it please the Court, Yasmin Best on behalf of the United States. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in deciding not to strike juror number 31 for cause. After having the opportunity to review her juror questionnaire, her responses to questions posed by both the Court and Defense Counsel, and then having the opportunity to assess both her credibility and her demeanor, the Court determined that she seemed to be a fair-minded person, stated that it would take all of her responses to its questions into account, and then decided not to strike her for cause.
But Ms. Best, I am worried about what she might have understood from the district judge in this section that I was referring to earlier, where the judge starts to talk about the presumption of innocence, and then he says there is not anything wrong with having an impact, which she might have understood, if you are influenced some by this former experience with your daughter, that's okay. But are you going to give the guy the benefit of the doubt? And she says yes. But if people start out with a bias, sometimes they overcompensate for a bias, sometimes they undercompensate, but if there's a bias, there's just a problem. I find this all very, it doesn't have the clarity of statement from her that we've looked for in other cases.
I would say first that I'm not sure that the court's reference to the impact necessarily goes to her bias or potential bias.
What does it go to? And what would she have understood? I mean, the judge says that. There it is in the record. And I don't know what she would have understood from that.
I believe that the court may have been getting more towards the idea that the impact is just the nature of the charges in general, that the potential crime against the juror's daughter was one of an attempted kidnapping or some sort of potential exploitation, that the nature of the charges in this case were a variety of child pornography.
I understand what the charge, I mean, we've read this, but what we have looked for, and as we said in the Thompson case, when the judges are able to get somebody to say, Your Honor, I will set aside all bias, or I can set aside all preconceptions, or there are many verbal formulations that will get us there, but it needs to be an unqualified statement. And this, with this unfortunate back and forth that's going on, with everybody talking at the same time, and I feel sorry for the court reporters trying to get this all down, the best you can come up with is, I would give him the benefit of the doubt until everything is presented. Maybe after everything is presented, she's not going to give him the benefit of the doubt anymore. I don't know what she's saying.
Well, I think first that this case can be distinguished from Thompson versus Altheimer and Gray, in that the court does press the juror a number of times to try to determine exactly whether she does have a bias and whether she can be impartial.
And until she finally says that, every time she answers his question, she keeps saying, I just have such a bad feeling about these kinds of things based on this earlier experience.
Well, I think a few pages earlier from the section that you were quoting before, she does state that she understands that that both sides are entitled to fairness, that that each side should have a clean slate in her mind, and that she would try to be open-minded. So it's over the course of a bit of time that she does state.
True, but then when the defense lawyer goes back and re-questions her about this, she's right back where she started. She's right back saying, well, this is going to have an effect on me.
Well, certainly the juror does not speak as artfully or as concisely as she could.
It's not artfulness. It's the content of what she's saying. She almost gets to the point of saying that she could be unbiased, but then the defense lawyer follows up with some questions, and then she's, as I say, she returns to saying, I just don't think I can get this out of my mind.
Well, I think, and this is why there is the deference to the district court, I believe the judge had the opportunity there to see what her responses were, how comfortable she felt responding to the court versus defense counsel.
I hope you see the problem. That is, Judge Wood and I also are concerned more about what questions the district judge was asking than with the answers. In a case like this, you need to keep two questions completely separate. And let's think of this. Suppose there's a murder prosecution, and you get a juror who says, I think all murderers deserve to be hanged immediately or shot down in the street. Murderers are terrible. Right? But the question at trial is the defendant a murderer? Right, so the juror has to be told, no, the question is not, what is your view of murderers? I assume most people think murderers are really bad, but can you distinguish that from the need to determine whether this person is a murderer? Right, that's the thing the judge has got to find out, whether the juror can keep separate. If you can't keep separate the question, what do I think about murderers, and is the defendant actually a murderer, then you can't serve. But if you can keep those things separate, then it's fine to serve. And the problem that Judge Wood is expressing that I have is, did Judge Kokoris ever get a clear answer about whether she could keep those things separate?
I'm not sure it's as explicit as that on the record, but I do think that that is what the judge is getting toward when he asks her whether she can keep a clean slate here and understand that the nature of the charges, while disturbing, do not necessarily go towards this particular defendant. And so her ability to serve persists even despite her past experience, because she states that she believes she would...
It would have been nicer if this were kept clean. One of the reasons why she's wandering back and forth is that both the judge and the lawyer keep asking questions that a layperson could have understood as, have I changed your mind so that you now like sex offenders? Or so that you now don't have any problem with sex offenders anymore? And she keeps saying, oh, yeah, I got a problem with sex offenders.
But I think that still, based on this, she does by the end make quite clear to the judge that she believes that she can be impartial in determining this person's guilt or innocence. And despite her own negative experience in the past, that that would not come to bear in terms of weighing the evidence in this particular case.
You know, if she had said what you just said, this would be a different. We wouldn't even be here, actually, because there would have been a verdict, and maybe we'd be here on sentence or something else. But she doesn't say that. The question isn't asked that cleanly, and she certainly never says it as concisely and in the focused way that you just did.
I certainly agree, and I think that's part of why this is an issue, that the juror does not have the ability, I think, to necessarily understand how crisp her answers have to be.
But it's up to the judge to get. That's why all we have is words and responses, and that's why we need the judge to get a clear, unequivocal answer from somebody before we can go forward. I'm mystified, actually. This is the Northern District of Illinois. This is not a district where two people live who are eligible for jury service. I can't fathom why, you know, this all got so far, but anyway.
Again, I would just state that I believe that the judge, by the time the colloquy is concluded, states explicitly he understood the concerns with her answers at the beginning of the colloquy, but by the end he was convinced that she could be fair-minded and wouldn't be fair to both sides. And that's because, unlike someone like me who's reading this on the record, purely he has the ability to assess the juror's credibility and demeanor at that time. And after hearing her responses to a fairly extended colloquy, became convinced that she could be fair. If the court has no further questions, I would just ask that the court would affirm Mr. Allen's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Best. Anything further, Mr. Blanken?
Yes. From what I just heard of the government's argument, it appears they're relying on credibility and demeanor, and I'd like to just address those two things. I don't believe this case involves an issue of credibility. The juror was obviously telling the truth to anyone who would listen to her that she had a problem sitting in this case. This is not a case where she said, I can be fair, and then the judge was supposed to just assess whether she could or not. And it's the same sort of situation that came up in Thompson versus Altimer and Gray. This is not a credibility issue. It's an issue of, were the unwavering statements given? With regard to demeanor, the district court put nothing on the record indicating that there was some, and I don't mean to be flip about this, but some sort of twinkle of fairness in the juror's eyes, or that she did something somehow suggesting that she could be fair.
What would that mean?
I don't know, but there's nothing suggesting that in the record. The government is
putting... Sounds like the kind of thing that only Yoda could see.
That's right.
That may be. There's nothing like that in the record. And even if there were, that sort of demeanor thing cannot trump the lack of an equivocal statement. And if the court has no further questions, I'll rest on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.